Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hi, everyone.
So, Mara, today we're talking to YNR's Peter Bergman, who I actually did not meet for a long time after I joined the magazine. So I was a big All My Children fan. As we know, I famously stopped watching when Jenny Gardner was killed off. But I was very into Cliff and Nina. And Peter always felt like a larger-than-life person to me. So it had to be about like 15 or so years ago now when I was invited to join him and Michelle Stafford, who was playing Phyllis at the time, for lunch with the show's publicists at the Four Seasons Hotel in L.A., and I really didn't know what to expect. So for starters, I was seated next to Peter, and I mean, he was just so thoroughly charming. He had the best stories and was like everything you would want in someone you held in high esteem and really so much more. And what's amazing about Peter is that he went from one hugely successful soap role and was tapped as a recast for a very popular Terry Lester on YNR and yet completely has made Jack Abbott his own.
Absolutely. Well, I have to say that I have only met Peter once, but it was at the reception for the daytime Emmy nominees this past spring at the Hollywood Museum, and I went over and introduced myself, and within 45 seconds, we were lovingly making fun of Billy Miller, and I was like totally at ease, totally charmed by him, and you know, so enjoyed like seeing like what a cool guy he is. But I do think that Peter is part of a pretty exclusive club of actors in this genre who not only have gone from huge success in one role to huge success in another, but who have done so playing completely disparate characters and, in a sense, reinventing themselves to the soap audience. I think as much as show execs would, you know, love it if the popularity an actor had on one show guaranteed that the same actor would be a hit on another, it just doesn't always work that way.
Oh, for sure. Take Stephen Nichols and Mary Beth Evans, who couldn't be more adored as Days' Stephen Kayla, you know, the anti-hero and heroine of Days. And then on GH, they were both cast against that type as Stefan and Catherine, and the pairing just wasn't as successful. Gina Francis is another one we could point to. I mean, obviously, she is so amazing as Laura and so identified as that character that All My Children's Sierra, Days' Diana, and YNR's Genevieve ultimately couldn't hold a candle to the original. Mm-hmm. You know, we also saw it back in the day with Another World's George Reinhold and Jackie Courtney, who went on to One Life to Live and didn't quite make the same splash. I mean, ditto Beth Ehlers and Ricky Paul Golden, who were such a hit as Guiding Lights' Gus and Harley, but didn't capture that same spark as All My Children's Jake and Taylor. And we are talking about beloved, popular, majorly talented stars, but it just wasn't the same when they went to another show.
You know, I think of someone like Judy Evans, who, of course, was amazing on Guiding Light as Beth, this fragile heroine with a tragic home life, won an Emmy for that role. And that was really kind of the same blueprint for Days of Our Lives as Adrienne when she came to Days of Our Lives in 1987. And she was an insta-hit there as well. Mm-hmm. But in between her stints as Adrienne, she went to another world to play this saucy vixen character of Paulina, hugely popular again. So, you know, it can be done. And I don't know what the magic ingredient is that makes it possible. But, you know, you think about someone like Nancy Lee Grahn, who became so popular as a neurotic lawyer on Santa Barbara and is still enormously popular playing a neurotic lawyer. But now it's on General Hospital as Alexis. And Peter's on-screen sister Eileen Davidson might kind of join him in this club that we're talking about because her iconic roles, of course, are YNR's Ashley and Days' Kristen.
For which she's won an Emmy for each.
Absolutely. But those characters are, you know, diametrically opposed to one another.
You know, and then you have a list of actors who started on one show and didn't necessarily make a huge splash, but were hired somewhere else and became really big stars.
Yeah, you know, who's popping into my head is Rebecca Budig. She was, like, fine as Michelle on Guiding Light. It wasn't a big role at the time. But then she went to All My Children and made a huge impact there very quickly as Greenlee.
I mean, to the point where there was an entire ad campaign based around her eventual return, which they touted as the real Greenlee. I mean, she was definitely beloved by Pine Valley fans.
Yeah, and probably an even better example is Peter Reckel.
Oh, absolutely.
He was on As the World Turns for, like, 2 years in a role that is really only remembered, if it is, because Peter Reckel played it, Eric Hollister, before taking like the daytime world by absolute storm when he was cast just a few short years later as Days' Beau. Mm-hmm. Even David Canary, who, you know, he was a recast Steve Frame on Another World.
Which seems so weird to me now to even think about him on that show.
Yeah, it's weird to think about him as playing anyone but Adam and Stewart. It's also odd to think that he was, like, chosen to succeed George Reinhold because physically they're so different from one another. So, you know, he was on Another World, and once again, he was fine. But then he goes to All My Children and becomes a legend playing the dual roles of Adam and Stewart.
You know, it's really like catching lightning in a bottle because it isn't always a success. You know, but in the case of Peter Bergman, there is no arguing that he is not only one of the most successful recasts in daytime history, but has managed to play two unbelievably popular roles that made indelible marks on their respective canvases. So let's get him on the phone and see what he has to say about his fabulous daytime career. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Steph. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good.
Well, we are so happy you could join us today. First of all, we have to start by saying how amazing your storyline and scenes have been. I mean, of course, always, but especially recently.
Oh, thanks. It's the hardest job I've had here yet, saying goodbye to Ashley. I just heartbreaking for me. Heartbreaking for me personally.
I'm sure. Well, what a send-off.
Yeah, it was a nice send-off, and I love that they gave her a real the diving board to make a clean exit on. But yeah, I think it's a loss for the show, and it's a giant loss for me. Giant loss.
I can only imagine. I mean, especially just in a way, you know, because it's been played so much lately, especially with over the past year with just so much Abbott drama, it's just the idea of it being incomplete in a sense now, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's you know, we still have the Dina thing to deal with. We still are rebuilding Chabot. We still, all of these things happen without Ashley. It's hard to imagine.
Yes, yeah. And you two have worked together for so many years. I mean, the bond between you felt so real.
And, you know, you watch daytime television. You know how this all works. You know, a couple breaks up, and then you wait a while to see where each of these actors is going to go next and everything. I never worried about that. When a marriage broke up, I still had to deal with Ashley at home.
Right,
you know,
good point.
It was like my other wife, you know, that I had to deal with. And losing that is very painful.
Although I have to say it's been wonderful and maybe even cushioning the blow a little bit to have Beth Maitland so prominent in the storyline.
Oh, I agree. And I am, whenever I am around people who could do anything about it, I am forever saying she is the beating heart of the Abbott family. You can have Jack and Abby and Kyle in the same room. You add Tracy and you have the Abbott family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it feels that way for the viewers. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does it mean to you to have seen such an Abbott reboot, in a sense, you know, over the last year or so?
Well, you know, every reboot I have kind of fought, you know. John Abbott dying I thought was unnecessary and terrible. And what it opened up for me was the chance to play the, you know, de facto patriarch of a family. And with that came all kinds of, you know, amazing things to get to play. And maybe this will be the same kind of thing. You know, I fought it every step of the way, but without Ashley there, something else is possible.
Right. But there's also just been so much great story with the family, you know, between Dina and now all, like, it's one revelation after another.
Yeah, very grateful for that. Very grateful for that. They really have focused on the Abbott family for a very long time. And I feel a little hoggish to want any more.
Well, we actually, Mar and I talked last week about how great those flashback scenes were.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm delighted to hear you say that. So when Mal, our executive producer, head writer, first suggested he was going to do that, I, you know, kind of smiled and said, oh, how about that? You know, and I thought, really? Is the audience going to? And when I finally saw them, I realized I was wrong, that there was something really touching about that. Some of the casting was great. I was particularly impressed with the little girl who played Ashley, who had to cover a lot of ground there, establishing the history of this brother-sister conflict. Mm-hmm. And she was very good. The kid that played me, I thought was lovely. But she particularly And of course, the little girl that played Tracy is just, you know, just glows with love and happy. And of course, she grew up to be the same Tracy. Oh, good. I'm glad you liked that.
Yeah, it was so cool what the set designers did and the lighting directors, we said.
It's that was pretty impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I also loved the garage scene with the old car.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, it was great.
So we thought it would be fun to go back to where it all began for you on Daytime, of course, as Dr. Cliff Warner on All My Children. And even before that, like, who was the Peter Bergman that auditioned for All My Children? What were you doing at the time? And how much, if at all, were soaps on your radar?
So Peter was a snobbish stage actor who didn't really know anything about daytime television. And my agent called about this All My Children role. And I said, I don't know. Do I want to audition for it? She said, Peter, it's work. You know, you're in town. I'd been doing theater out of town and coming back. And I'd saved enough money on the road to, you know, pay for my rent in New York and have a little left over. And that little left over would come to an end and I'd be waiting tables again. And then I'd get another theater thing and I'd leave. So anyway, I worked a lot of restaurants in New York, and, you know, I had lots of different interests. I was learning to play the piano. I started when I was 21, and I still play. And there were lots of things to keep me. I loved New York. I loved life in New York. And the actual audition for All My Children was almost didn't happen. I had three auditions that day. One was for a new Tennessee Williams play called Vieux Carré. They were doing it up on at the York Theater on the Upper East Side. And the day before, I had gone in to they wouldn't let the script out of the theater. So I sat there and read a whole play backstage. Wow. And gave it back to them. And my audition was the next day. But the same day, I had a commercial audition in the morning. And then I brought a change of clothes and changed clothes, I don't even remember where, and got to the York Theater and worked on the scene and went out there. Jose Quintero, who directed pretty much all the famous, you know, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Streetcar Named Desire, all those on Broadway, was directing this thing. So I was auditioning for Jose Quintero. I was thrilled with that. And I went out in my, when they finally called me out, and I went out on stage and did my little monologue. It's kind of a Southern accent talking about angry lupos ripping at my flesh. It was called Vieux Carré or some section of New Orleans. Anyway, almost from the moment I started, I just misstepped. And, you know, nothing was going like I wanted it to go. And finally, I heard this very faint voice say, thank you. And I left dejected and awful. And I went home, and my agent never followed up on my auditions. And Rhonda called to say, hey, I know how much that meant to you. How did it go? I said, it went awful, Rhonda. I'm awful. You should get rid of me as a client. It was terrible. She said, well, don't forget, you have that All My Children audition later today. And I swear, Stephanie, I thought, oh. Oh, no. Oh, I got to go to that. That turned into 10 years of work, turned into 39 years of work in daytime television.
That's incredible. Do you remember that audition? Who did you?
I remember it very well.
Who was there?
I was auditioning to play Chuck. Chuck. Yes, and the girl I was auditioning with was there to play to audition for Betsy, a nurse that was new. And they explained as I kind of went through the process that it wasn't actually Chuck I was auditioning for; that they had this role of Cliff in mind. And as they explained a little bit more, it was kind of a gothic storyline and a sweet and a virginal and delicate Nina has a father who's a very powerful guy and very manipulative and has a kind of a weird protection of his daughter. And when I finally got the part, and I think I kind of got through the first two stages not caring. That kind of worked for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just went for it, you know, because who cares if I don't get this? And I got the role, and I never want to make you think I'm that secure. As the process went on, the closer I got to getting it, the better it seemed, and the more I wanted it. And
of course, as it always does.
My snobbishness really kind of abated a good bit. Anyway, they literally hired me and asked me not to work for the next 4 weeks. They paid me not to work.
Wow.
While they went and found Nina and Palmer.
That's incredible.
And I took a trip out to California and saw my sister and her husband and saw my friend Marcia, who was up at ACT in San Francisco and studying theater, and came back and met Taylor Miller in the hair room as I was introduced to her. And she later told me that in 10 minutes of conversation, I mentioned my wife 3 times. So I was obviously kind of taken with her. So I need to make sure I knew and she knew I was married. And the amazing James Mitchell, who in many ways transformed my life.
I'd love to hear you speak about your relationship with James. That was such an amazing and kind of unique aspect of the love story of Cliff and Nina was, you know, Palmer is very much the dangerous third wheel.
Yeah, he just did not like Cliff Warner. He didn't have good feelings, but he just didn't like him to his core, and it made us, you know, marvelous rivals in that time. But during that time, this is James Mitchell, who was a legend in the dance world and who had you know, quite a resume, both on Broadway and off Broadway for many years. And this was kind of his return to working regularly. And here's the cool thing. I was 26 years old when I started daytime television. James Mitchell was 60 years old. So I had the advantage of having a guy next to me who had already been through the mill, had already been chewed up, spit out, and so he knew what a tremendous and unique opportunity this was, and he acted like it. And by dint of standing next to him, I started to do the same thing. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. He came in, he knew his stuff inside out. So I realized, yeah, that's what we should be doing. Know your stuff inside out. There were plenty of people there that were learning their lines at the last minute. But I was working around James Mitchell, and I didn't want him to ever see me phoning it in.
Mm-hmm.
He was just the loveliest man. Barely a birthday happened in our house, mine or my wife's or my children's, that we didn't hear from James Mitchell.
That's
he was
so
that
sweet.
Thorough. Yeah, lovely, lovely man. A quick James Mitchell story.
Yeah.
We used to tape the scenes where they would kind of flow into another scene. They didn't have to do any post-production because there would be 3 cameras on one scene, and one of them, toward the end of the scene, would kind of disappear and go across to another set, and they would flow from that scene right into our scene. James and I had a big knockdown drag-out. He brought his diabetic daughter in. She needed an emergency appendectomy. The only surgeon there is this resident, Cliff Warner, and he's not letting any resident anywhere near his daughter. Something has to happen, and I have to tell this guy, this is an emergency. This has to be done now. We can't get anyone else in here, and he was not hearing it. So anyway, it was a lengthy scene and a serious argument, and while we were waiting for the cameras to come over our way, I whispered to James Mitchell, "Are you nervous right now?" He said to me, "I'm terrified."
Aww.
We started the scene.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's classic James. Yeah. I did not have a place for terrified. Oh my God.
At what point did it become clear to you that Cliff was taking off and becoming a popular character on the show?
You know, I have to be honest, I was so unaware of so much. Looking back, we were riding the crest of the daytime wave. It was as big as soap operas ever were. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. I assumed, you know, everybody who'd ever worked in daytime television had experienced what we were experiencing. We were showing up at malls and, you know, they put out very little information and 3,000 people show up. And I thought, oh, so this is what it's like to work in daytime.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah, it never kind of occurred to me that I'd kind of broken into some kind of special world at just the right time when everyone was finally saying, oh, I've been watching soap operas for a long time, when kids in college were scheduling their classes around daytime television, when, you know, it was just a fantastical time. It was. I was going to go to my 10th high school reunion, and 1 week before, I was on the cover of People magazine.
Wow.
I thought, wow, this is crazy. This is crazy. But when the audience bought us, neither Taylor or I ever had any sense that, this is working. We were just trying to keep our jobs and make it all, you know, and keep the directors happy.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe soaps in the 80s that you were riding that crest? What was it like then, especially as compared to now?
Well, it was just a phenomenon. Everywhere you went, you were recognized. It was the stuff of, you know, everyday culture. People were talking about Luke and Laura on, you know, and it seemed like on Meet the Press almost. It was, you know, it was so much a part of our culture. Elizabeth Taylor is going on General Hospital. Carol Burnett can't get enough of us when we're in Los Angeles. She wants to invite us to her house and then comes and works on our show. And it was just a crazy time. It was such fun.
Did you ever go to her house?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. More than
wow.
once. More than once. Yeah. Yeah. It was just a terrific thing. And the first time I ever went there, we were out here to play The Family Feud. We, you know, a handful of us from All My Children came out to embarrass ourselves. Or, well, actually, they did better than I did. I was not very good at the game show.
Really?
Yeah, I'm too self-conscious. When we were out, she invited us to her house. And when we pulled up the driveway, this long, long gated driveway, she and Vicki Lawrence and some others were standing in her driveway wearing All My Children t-shirts to greet us.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. It was an amazing. So the first year I, well, now this is now leaving All My Children. The first year I won the Emmy, it was the number one show on television that week, all week.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. The next day in New York City, I mean, just getting on a bus, people were saying, hey, congratulations. Hey, it was great last night. Stuff like that.
Oh,
walking
my God.
On a New York City bus?
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a wild ride.
Peter, as a side note, I've just searched for and located your cover of People magazine, looking very fresh-faced and handsome in your scrubs.
It was such a weird thing. I came out here. I did not get any sleep. I went to this thing. Jamie Lynn Bauer was pregnant, and
Josh Taylor.
Yeah, Josh Taylor.
Yeah, hit it off great, and we went out and got very drunk that night. great fun. Yeah, he took me all over Los Angeles.
Showed you the hot spots.
It was really fun.
Now, another sort of claim to fame that you had around the same time is the infamous commercial where you uttered the lines, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
It was the craziest audition I ever had. The only people there were people who played doctors on daytime television.
Oh, really?
It's absolutely true. So Michael Storm is there with me. Oh, from Ryan's Hope. Oh, crap. I liked him so much, too. Anyway, there were all these guys that played doctors on television. And I got this thing, and it abused the airwaves for 3 years. I'm really not exaggerating when I say, and I'd love to tell you I put it all in one fund and this is what it did, but it basically paid for my kids' college education. One day of work.
Wow.
For both of my kids' college educations.
Who could have imagined from that one day of work?
It was nuts. I'm working on all my children. I have a regular salary there. And you would get these kind of surprise checks in the mail. And because, you know, there was no kind of schedule to it all. And with commercials, they send you the check. And with it, it shows air dates. So it would say, you know, 11-1, 11-2, 11-6. And, you know, the days that it aired. And I would get these checks, nice checks, and it would say 11-1, 11-1, 11-1, 11-1, 11-1, 11-1, 11-2, 11-2, 11-2. It just, during flu season and cold season, it just aired all day long.
Well, so if you got recognized the day after you won the Emmy, what was it like after this commercial was airing so much?
Well, the only thing I'm not sure I'm answering your question. The only thing I remember being kind of weird about it all was it too became part of the American zeitgeist. You know, it was one of those "Where's the beef?" kind of commercials where comedians were making lots of jokes, and I was sitting next to my pregnant wife one night when somebody was saying, oh, and these commercials were these, you know, I'm Martha Ray, denture wearer. Or the other one, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. I've seen you play a doctor on TV. You're not very good at that either.
Oh, my God.
You know, and ouch. Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was covering my wife's stomach so the baby didn't.
Of course, good. And he didn't watch, if that's what he said. Come on now. So there you were then at the highest highs of, you know, being on this successful show and having just all this fame that came along with it. How did you feel when ultimately then Cliff was written out?
It was one of the more devastating things that ever happened to me. And I'm ashamed of that. I'm kind of embarrassed by that. What? You're an actor. Your job's end. What is this? I had so embraced the whole thing. I had become so much a member of that company. In my social life, my whole life was built into being on All My Children. That's probably a mistake, you know. But I had become such a company member there that it just hammered me. My wife was 7 months pregnant with our second kid. We had just bought the apartment next door to us and joined it to our apartment.
Wow.
The timing of it was absolutely horrid. And there was, as happens with every job for everyone, not just actors, that feeling that they're going on without me. And I recovered from it about 3 years later.
Wow.
Here's my the story I like to tell. This will kind of help you understand just how powerful it was. The job comes to an end. My last day on All My Children, I found out it was coming to an end a couple months earlier. My last day of All My Children, they pull out a cake and they say nice words and everything, and I get a little teary. My wife is there, round as can be, with a big baby, and we go out and go home after the cake, Mary Ellen and I, to pack my bag for Los Angeles, where I'm auditioning to replace a character on a show I'd never watched, Young and the Restless. Mm-hmm. By that time, I knew a lot of the soap operas, but this one was always opposite All My Children. So I never really saw it, I told Debbie Morgan, she's the only person I told because she was a major Y&R fan, and she said, oh, Peter, this is the role of a lifetime, believe me. So I took her word for it, and I went home, packed my bags, and I went and got this job a glorious thing. I can go back and tell you more stories about that. A year and a half after that, I win my first Emmy Award. And I was thrilled with that. And I had, the night of the Emmys, I had gone to dinner with all my children friends, David Canary, Mo, myself, Bob Woods came along. They were all my New York soap friends. And afterwards, I got together with all my New York soap friends and said, I got to go to the Y&R party. I really should because I won, you know. So I got over there and everybody was very nice to me and everything. But I still hadn't let go of all my children. The following year, I win again. And the next morning, we were supposed to meet at Sarah Beth's Kitchen on the Upper West Side, our friends Bill and Ivitz, and we walked past the All My Children building, and it had been leveled. It's a big pile of bricks.
Oh my God.
And I stood where the loading gate used to be in the back, and I wept like a baby.
Aww. That's the sweetest story.
It was like I needed someone to say, Peter, geez, move on. You've got two Emmys now from the other show. Move on. So anyway, I went to breakfast, just kind of fragile, and after breakfast was going to go meet with James Mitchell and went over to his place. And hung out with him and had lunch and yakked it up, and then went back to my hotel room. And my wife, who had gone to Mary Ellen, had gone over to see a friend of hers on the east side after breakfast. And when I got to my hotel room, there was a brick sitting there.
Aww.
That sits in my dressing room right now. I'm looking at it.
Oh my God.
Peter, you're like destroying us emotionally right now.
It's crazy. That's how long I held on to it. So your question, you know, so the All My Children thing came to an end. How did that go? It was devastating. I got over it 3 years later.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to even imagine because, you know, you are irrefutably one of the most successful recasts in daytime history.
And it worked out. I'm so glad.
I mean, really, to come from that, you know, devastation to really be where you are now and then to have been so successful right out of the gate is such a testament to you.
I literally have that brick in my dressing room to remind me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, were you trepidatious in the beginning about playing Jack?
Oh, it's very trepidatious. For starters, none of the replacements worked on All My Children. None of them. We had a bunch of replacements in my 10 years there, and it just never worked out. So I was trepidatious about that. I was trepidatious about moving to California. I was a real New York snob, and I had lived out here for a little while and didn't like it. And I thought, oh man. So everything you don't want to do, you don't want to replace someone on a soap opera. You're not sure you want to do another soap opera. You just left one, and you don't want to move to California. And so I was doing all three. With a brand new baby and all of that attendant madness, and I came out here, and you kind of assume, well, you've been doing daytime television for 10 years. It's just, you know, you just go do it in another building. It could not have been more different. Where I had been was so much more of a kind of a family of actors, all kind of looking out for each other, and I got here, and all I could see was people kind of locked in their dressing rooms, and there was, at the very top of the food chain, people who were really dismissive about the work and didn't, you know, care about it, or what, I didn't care about it, it's the wrong thing. They just, you know, preparation wasn't a big deal, and there were cue cards here, and I thought, God, this is weird. This is like nothing I've ever done before, and I've been an actor for a while. And, you know, part of the story, as I lay it out for you now, is me not ready to let go of something else and making this an unpleasant place in order to feel sad about what I'd left. Mm-hmm. There was probably plenty of camaraderie and company spirit here, and I just didn't see it. So it was very lonely work early on. I would come back to my dressing room and think, wow, how long are the prop guys going to know more about Jack Abbott than I do? I mean, they were,
yeah,
you know,
I get that.
Everybody here had a real clear idea of who Jack Abbott was, and I'm just trying to figure it out myself. So it was daunting. It was pretty daunting coming here, and there were actors who liked Terry Lester and missed him and weren't sure they got this or it took a while. It took a while for it to feel normal.
Was there a moment or a storyline that you feel kind of solidified you as Jack for you or for the audience or for your castmates or for anyone, like any defining moment?
Was there a moment? I think there was. Well, here's a longer story. I probably held that attitude for too long. And one day my wife said to me, who's much smarter than I am, said to me, Peter, why don't you quit this job? I said, what? She said, I don't want your kids to hear you speak ill of the work anymore, and the people don't learn their lines, and all the negative stuff. If you're unhappy, we'll give some things up and you go get another job or turn this around. Probably the 5-year mark. So I decided I have to try to turn this around. So I invited all of these, the Abbotts generally, to a dinner here that Marilyn and I hosted. And I went to Tiffany and got a bunch of crystal glass, the letter A, the capital letter A for the Abbotts, and Veronica Red Forest was there with her husband, and Brenda Epperson was there with her husband, and Beth Maitland was there with hers. Jerry Douglas and Kim were there, and Jess Walton and her husband John were there. And at that dinner, they all started talking. I toasted them all, and they all started talking about me as such a critical member of the company that I was just shocked. I was shocked. I thought, boy, I've been standing outside this thing for a really long time, and they all thought I had been, you know, deeply involved with all of them. And it really was. It was humbling. It was, oh, Peter, you keep missing stuff. You keep missing the signals. And I think that night I really felt like I was really part of the company.
I mean, I wish we had a camera looking at us. I'm just grinning listening to these stories. They're really so incredible.
Yeah, I really have had a remarkable life in daytime television. So it's you know, I'm happy to do these podcasts and talk about this stuff because I have had all of these lessons, and a lot of them are, you know, wake up, Peter lessons, you know, as I've shared with you. But they're valuable life lessons. Don't let life go by. Get engaged. Get involved. Reach out. Make contact. I had a life that taught me that.
Peter, I'm interested too, you know, talking about you going from All My Children to Young and the Restless and the eras in which you were at each show. You had contact with these two amazing icons creatively behind the scenes of the genre, Agnes Nixon at All My Children and Bill Bell at the Young and the Restless.
Unbelievable, isn't that? Both Erna Phelps kids.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What are your memories of the two of them?
So that transition was fantastic and shaped me to this day in this way. Agnes Nixon could not have been sweeter, kinder, more just this sweet little woman that came by the studio or came to Christmas parties and things like that. So the powerhouse Agnes Nixon image was really hard. hard to grasp with you know the what the visual gave out. It turns out she was a tremendous powerhouse. But the one thing that was made clear to me by any and everyone who thought about it, she did not want to hear from actors about their character. She didn't want any input from any of us. She wanted to write the show. So I never even thought for a moment of doing that. Fast forward, I'm now 10 years later working for Bill Bell, the other, you know, monstrous talent in daytime television. And the same was true for him. He did not need or want any input from actors. So Bill passes, and it's time for the next, you know, group of head writers to come in. And it was a Shakespearean effort to grab the scepter after Bill stepped aside. And we went through a number of writers, and each of them was eager to hear from actors. Some of them, there was a veritable revolving door up there of actors coming in, pitching ideas, and this is what we could do with my character. And to this day, I cannot do it. I can't. I literally get a little sweaty when Mal wants to talk to me about my character.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
It doesn't feel right. I just get a little creeped out by it. Because of my early training.
It's so interesting because, as you mentioned, both of these phenomenal creative forces were trained by Erna Phillips, who, forget, you know, taking pitches from actors, she wouldn't even call actors by their real names. She only would refer to them by their characters.
I think the same is true. I think both Agnes and Bill learned to do it otherwise, but I think left to their own devices or behind closed doors, they only called us by our character names. I'm convinced of that.
It's amazing.
But yeah, I got to work with two of the legends, the absolute legends. And Bill Bell, when I first started my job, he said to me, one of my favorite things a writer has ever said to me, he said, here's the deal, and you have to trust me on this, Peter. The secret to replacing someone is giving the replacement story so good that the audience doesn't care who's playing it.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
To this day, I think it's a pretty good axiom. I think it's a pretty good plan.
Yeah, and he went ahead and wrote you 2 years worth of Emmy-meriting storyline right out of the gate.
Right, yeah.
So in the same vein, you mentioned sort of right at the top of us talking about the Abbotts that there are things that you see in a script and you're like, oh, that's maybe not going to work or however you said it. Are you the kind of actor that would ever push back and say, I wouldn't do that or my character wouldn't do that?
No, I don't do that. I just don't do that. Now I have had lines. I'll give you an example. One of the writers, and this is not one of the head writers, one of the dialogue writers, wrote a scene literally for me today where I'm sitting with Billy and talking in kind of a glib manner about, well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, you and Phyllis did that to me, you know, and blah, 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 and ha, 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 and I called up right away to say, could we just cut a couple of these lines that I think this is the most painful thing that ever happened to Jack, and I'm not sure how he's ever going to be glib about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very accepting of that idea. Well, because, again, this was, you know, one writer's idea, and I could probably talk that writer into understanding, you know, my perspective on it. But it isn't me saying, I won't play this. I asked for two sentences to be removed, you know, and that I will do, but that's not sitting with the head writer and saying this is who Jack Abbott is.
Right, which is very different from, let's say, other people we've heard from.
Yeah, I tell you, we got a lot of them.
Yeah.
And frankly, I can't blame them. Many writers would love to hear from them. Come with ideas. I'm happy to have new ideas. You know, give me, you know, if I don't use your idea, it will trigger another idea, I've been told. But I can't do it.
Now, have there been things that you've privately winced to yourself about having to do?
Sure. You know, there was a whole storyline that I thought, this makes no sense. And I can tell you what storyline it was. Yeah. It was the Lawn storyline. Jack, it turns out, mm-hmm. served in Vietnam. It wasn't a heroic memory for him. In fact, he kind of hid out for a lot of the war with this woman he fell madly in love with and who it turns out he had a child with. But he runs into her one day here in the States and of all places, Genoa City, and falls for her all over again. And in order for it to work, Jack Abbott, as we knew him, was a cad and pretty merciless and a real manipulator. Suddenly, I'm pushing buttons with Brad and cutting his legs off at work and rubbing Jill's nose and her mistakes and manipulating this one and that one and going home and being the sweetest, caring person. Oh, my God. Stephanie, it was just, it was painful. It was just painful for me. And I did 2 years of that. 2 years of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Earned your money. This,
but I could name, you earn your money. That's right. That's not my job. It's not my job to write. It's my job to make this script work. And that's kind of my deal. And you know, I really do take that seriously. You know, people say, you know, after you've been there for that long, do you really care? Do I care if I walk in my dressing room? They always deliver them to my dressing room. I walk in my dressing room and there's one or two or four new scripts there. The world stops till I read them. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to find out what happens next. I really can't wait.
That says a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
So now as you look back on our discussion and everything we've kind of gone through today, you know, what does it mean to you that, as you said, like 39 years later in this, here you are still front burner, still, you know, an icon of daytime and of Young and the Restless? And could you ever have imagined this is where your career would go and your path would go and where you'd be today?
I never imagined for a moment that it would turn into this. A job I almost didn't audition for that when I finally got, I decided I could make it last for 6 months, turned into 10 years. That job comes to an end. And Melody Thomas Scott, who's in a plane on her way to Canada with the executive producer of our show, Ed Scott, shows him these magazines. I guess everyone was kind of surprised that my job and all my children had ended. And she points to this picture of me as they'd already been auditioning Terry Lester's replacement. They'd taped 7 auditions. And she said, "That's Jack Abbott." And they called me. And that turned into, I have been far and away the luckiest actor I know in this entire medium. And I've known that for probably 15 years. I've known that, you know, to the core of me. So to say that I am grateful is just a giant understatement. I am dumbstruck at how well this has all gone. I meet people all the time who have birthdays and think, oh, darn, by the time I was this age, I was kind of hoping I'd, you know, this or that. My life has always been so far ahead of my expectations, I'm almost embarrassed by it. It almost sounds like I didn't aim high enough. But my life has been full of positive things. This terrible thing happens, my job ends at all my children, and something even better happens is extraordinary. So I've learned a lot in that. The last thing that I've learned and the best thing that I've learned, because of this job, in no way, it's not something that I earned. It's something that was given to me, a gift that was given to me. And I realized this many years ago. I can make someone's day nicer by taking 2 minutes to say, "Oh, where are you from? Uh-huh. So is your grandma still alive?" Those yeah. kind of things, that little effort, I can make someone's day. I've been given this incredible gift. And if I didn't use it, I would be, I think there's something criminal about that. And it's been just a giant gift in my life. You should see what my life is like when I meet strangers all the time. All the time that say, I used to watch this with my grandmother. I'd sit there with her, and we'd talk about characters, and I learned about people and oh, my gosh, it's so humbling because I took the time to ask a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the impact is so great.
Yeah, it's a great thing. It's a great thing. And I get to meet people like you guys who have always been so, you know, smart and brought this sharp perspective to what I think has become a more and more sophisticated, you know, kind of show. Writing wise, it's gone from something that was pretty elemental to some more complex stuff. And all along, there were people like you who looked at it in a complex way, who looked at it as something more than just, you know, pablum for the masses. Oh no, the good stuff on this is really good, and I'm grateful for that too.
Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate that.
And of course, we appreciate you being here, just all the cooperation we've gotten from you over the many years.
Yeah.
And I really feel like we just scratched the surface. We could go on all day, but...
I could do this with you for a long time. I've known you for a long time, so it'd be easy to do, but I'm really grateful for the time I did have with you today.
Thank you.
Let's
ditto.
Call this one part one.
Part one.
We'll do a part two. We definitely need a follow-up.
All right, well, have a great day, Peter.
We'll do part two someday.
Thank you.
All right, you take care, Peter.
Perfect. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Peter Bergman for being our guest. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.